Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CIV, Slavery. Slaves were an integral part of the Roman society, responsible for much of the domestic duties and manual labour for any self-respecting and vaguely wealthy Roman citizen. Life as a slave was harsh. You were treated as property, the best you could hope for was freedom, and the worst, being worked to death. But on the upside, question mark, is that without slaves, Rome wouldn't be the clothed-in-marble city we know it as today. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Slaves were central to Roman power, the Roman economy, and the Roman Empire. They were a free source of labour, and they made Rome into a very powerful society, a slave society, like many other ancient Mediterranean economies. But of course, the Romans had access to a lot more slaves because they conquered so many more peoples.
Mm. So give me a bit more detail about that. What was the main source of Roman slaves?
Well, originally, they were all conquered in warfare. So in very early times, sort of mid-Republic, Romans probably enslaved other Italians, because they were conquering the peninsula of Italy.
Yeah.
But very quickly it becomes people from outside of Italy, around the Mediterranean, places that Rome conquers. One of the things they do in warfare is that they tend not to just kill everybody they conquer. They will maybe kill adult males. It depends on the situation, depends how if they feel the enemy has been treacherous or deceitful. But they will certainly enslave the women and the children, possibly some of the males as well.
Mm.
And they'll bring them back to Italy to do all kinds of work. For example, Josephus tells us that in the imperial period, Titus took 97,000 into slavery in the war against Jerusalem.
Mm.
That wasn't unusual. Sometimes, you know, in the Republic, they had just in one war taken 150,000 Greeks into slavery. So this is happening throughout. After that initial burst of empire, though, even though they do still take foreign peoples into slavery, as in the example with Titus, you, of course, have a situation where wherever the slaves are in the household or doing other jobs, they might have children, the female slaves, and any child born to a female slave is also a slave. So
okay.
If it happens in the household, the Roman word for slave is servus. That sound is actually a V, so it gives us servile. But if a slave born into the household has a different name, they're called a werna, which means somebody who's come from the household.
Okay, again with a V.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah.
V-E-R-N-A. And the Roman familia, the family, it doesn't mean family, it means household, and that includes the slaves. So you often would have slaves generated from your household slaves.
Okay, so if I'm in Rome and I have a household, I'm just trying to get a gauge on how accurate Hollywood is in this depiction. Would I go to the local slave market? There'd be a stage there. A slave would get let out of a cage and I'd start to bid.
There is a slave market, and slaves, they're not necessarily all auctioned, but they would be set at a certain price, perhaps. There were two slave markets in Rome, for instance. One was up in the Campus Martius, but the main one was in the Forum, which is the marketplace, amongst other things, just behind the Temple of Castor, which is a market for luxury goods. So slaves are property. This is where you would go, yeah, to buy slaves. They'd kind of come with a little description quite often. So recently, this is not in Rome, but in Britain, fairly recently, a tablet was found which had a description of a slave for sale on it. It has lines like guaranteed not to run away, healthy, good teeth,
yeah,
things like that. So it's, I guess, parallel with buying an animal. And indeed, there are quite a few parallels you could make between the way that we treat animals and the way the Romans think about slaves.
So what sort of rights did slaves have then? Clearly, they didn't own themselves. They didn't have many rights at all. But what could be done to somebody who's a slave?
Almost anything by the owner. They have no rights over their bodies or their will. They could be put to any work. You could literally use a slave as a sex slave, both male and female slaves. There were a lot of slaves in brothels. There's all kinds of jobs you could be given. You also have no rights over, I said, if you're a woman and you give birth to a child, then that child is a slave if you're a slave. and might be separated from them at any point because whoever owns the female slave also owns the offspring. You don't have the right to kin, basically. You don't have the right to a family. You don't have the right to get married, which is a really important Roman right, what they call connubium. They don't recognize that between slaves, which means you can't have legitimate offspring. Mm. So that's one of the worst things, I guess, we might imagine about being a slave in antiquity is you don't know when you're going to be torn away from people you're related to or people you formed a bond with because you can be moved around and sold on at the whim of your master.
Mm. Now, I know this number would fluctuate during time, but how many slaves were there in Rome?
There's a good estimate made by Keith Hopkins, about 25% of the population of Rome in the late Republic, early Empire was slaves.
Mm.
He's sort of plucking this number out of the air in a way, although it's kind of based on him being an economic historian, that if you have over 20% of the population being involved in the economy, being an important part of your society, then that makes you a slave society. Mm. What he means is you might have societies that have some slaves, but they don't kind of support the society by their existence.
Yeah.
But he says Rome and ancient Athens were, and we can attest that. And there may have been others, but we have enough evidence from these two ancient examples to say that Rome and Athens were slave societies.
Basically, they wouldn't have got to where they were if it wasn't for slaves propping up the economy and the production. And
they'd have had to get there in a very different way. So they were kind of an important strut. This is really dehumanizing slaves, but I mean in terms of their part in society. Yeah. They were an important strut in that society and in the way the economy worked.
Yes.
They formed property and they did work.
I feel I should make that very clear as well. Slavery is bad, but it's impossible to talk about this sort of thing without dehumanizing them because that's what the Romans did. We're talking about this the way that Romans saw them, at least on paper, as property, as something to be used and exploited.
Yeah, and look, it's complicated because sometimes they will talk about slaves in a way that seems affectionate.
Yeah, but they are so rare that they are exceptional.
They are, and I guess what's important to point out is that there is no real evidence that Romans thought that there was something wrong with the society being set up in this way. That free and slave is such an important divide in their society that even though you can go from being a slave to becoming a freed person, that stigma is always there that you have at one point in your life been a slave and you've been exposed to whatever slaves might be exposed to. You can never get rid of that from the free Roman point of view.
Mm. So who could own a slave?
Pretty much anyone. Anyone who's free and in weird circumstances, even if you were a slave, you could on paper own another slave.
So like a slave in charge of a household can have a slave.
Yeah, and ownership becomes a very grey area there.
How low would you have to be the slave of a slave?
Well, it happened in the imperial household.
Yes.
So we have inscriptions that talk about somebody belonging to someone who is a slave of the Emperor Augustus.
Mm.
All right, so you kind of have divisions of slaves in those circumstances, but we're talking really massive households. And very humble households would have slaves as well to do the menial work.
Right, so you don't have to be lavishly rich or anything like that.
Absolutely not. It's normal to have one or two slaves in your household, even if you're not a particularly wealthy family, this is an aside, is one of the beefs I have with an otherwise enjoyable Doctor Who episode, the Fires of Pompeii. There don't seem to be any slaves in that household. I think they're just not prepared to let this nice family engage in something as horrible as slavery.
Like all good slaves, they were always off screen.
They were in the shadows.
Doesn't matter if they didn't survive the eruption. As long as Peter Capaldi makes it out.
Yeah.
So if even the humble households could have a slave or two, or usually did have a slave or two, it's a real mark of what it means to be a Roman citizen, I suppose, to have a couple of slaves.
Yeah. And the more slaves you have, the more status you can show.
Yeah.
And by the way, women could also own slaves, even though, again, technically women couldn't own property without it being controlled by a guardian in most circumstances. But in reality, they did own property and slaves were part of that property.
So I guess this also gets back to slaves being seen as property. They are essentially just part of the house furniture almost, and the owner can do anything that they want with them.
Yeah, so it's part of Roman comedy quite often is to talk about slaves having marks on their back. This is something that apparently audiences found funny. So that suggests that whipping was common, that slaves were punished in quite extreme ways. And there's a story that the Emperor Domitian put a slave to death for making his bath too cold. That story in itself shows us that Domitian is extreme, that he's cruel, but he's kind of the extreme end of what could be done. So Domitian doesn't get punished for that. I mean, he's the emperor anyway. But, you know, that's seen as something that most people wouldn't do because most people are rational and normal. But it's not against the law.
Yeah,
there
yeah.
is no law that supports the rights of slaves. He can do it if he wants to. There is a law that does kind of touch on slaves. We know about it because of an incident in Tacitus's Annals in book 14, where he tells us the story of a man called Pedanius Secundus who is murdered. And he has a large household with 100 slaves, and the law says that they can all be put to death because they're all under suspicion, even though only one of them carried it out. It's actually quite an interesting case because the implication that Tacitus gives it is that the murder might have been over an argument about one of the slaves' lover, who Pedanius Secundus has also been involved in. So some kind of love triangle, maybe. And this goes to the Senate. So this is seen as cruel too. This law, which asserts that all the slaves would be punished because they've got to be made an example of, and we can't let the murderer get away with it if it's a slave. The Senate does see as cruel, but in the end,
it gets carried out. Yeah.
So you can see the sort of tensions at the edge here, that there is an idea of the concept of some cruelty to the slaves being too extreme. But in the end, the rights of the free will always be asserted more strongly. So one of the arguments made in the Senate is that if we let this happen, you know, nobody can feel safe in their home because we're all at the mercy of the slaves in our home.
Yeah,
and the idea is that we've got these slaves, some of them we might even feel close to, but in the end, they are the enemy. And originally they were the enemy, of course, when they were captured in warfare. And it's never quite lost that tinge that there might be danger from slaves. They might be hating you. They're not your kin. They're not part of your family, really. They're people you keep close, but we're anxious about them always. So this might be unjust, but it's an injustice we've got to live with in order to feel safe.
Yeah, yeah. The capturing in warfare thing, there must have been some slaves that have been more valuable than others.
Yeah.
So you got Greek slaves, I suppose, that would be valued for their culture and their knowledge, maybe?
They might be. If well-educated, they certainly were. So in the mid to late Republic, one of the other markers of status is to have a Greek slave who educates your children, especially your sons.
But maybe a hairy Gaul is not as valuable?
No, but they might be valuable for their bodily strength, for example.
Ah, you put them in the mines. All right, let's talk about functions then. So you've got household slaves who doing your cooking, your cleaning, your bath drawing, your child minding, going and getting food, all that kind of household
cleaning stuff. If
you've
got lots of slaves,
stuff,
then there are relief sculptures that seem to show, you know, four women doing one woman's hair.
Yes.
That kind of job. So yeah, they'd be doing all kinds of household activities, some of which would be tough, but in general, being a household slave is potentially the best life to have as a slave.
So what other roles could slaves have in the Roman world?
Well, they could be put to work in all kinds of places. If they were well-educated, if they could read, they might have kind of secretarial-type roles, especially within the imperial household or within a politician's household during the Republic. We've been talking about writers like Pliny the Elder writing, but he wasn't writing. He had a slave scribe to do the actual writing.
Yes.
He just dictated.
Yeah.
So those kind of jobs, again, probably at the better, kinder end of the scale, unless you had a bad master like Domitian.
Yeah, unless your penmanship was just terrible.
Then if you didn't have those kind of skills at all.
If you got your V's and your V's mixed up. Sorry, keep going.
If you were better at manual work, or you didn't have those skills, so you were given manual work to do anyway, there are two main places you might end up. One of them is on a farm. And this might be, especially from the mid-Republic onwards, it might be a huge farm called Latifundium, which is a big estate.
Yeah.
And this is when the elite of Rome were buying up farms, turning them into huge estates and servicing them with slaves. If you worked there, you might be engaged in some really tough agricultural work. Cato the Elder In his manual on farming, he has this sort of now infamous statement where he says, you know, with older slaves who aren't in use anymore in the farm, you don't keep them anymore, sell them on or let them die. So this is a very utilitarian
Cato
approach.
Said that.
Yeah.
P.S. Carthage must be destroyed.
See, you don't think so highly of him anymore, do you? So, you know, it probably was an extremely tough life. Cato seems to have been an extremely tough person in his attitude, so maybe not every slave was treated like that on a farm. Nevertheless, you can imagine there's a lot of hard work to go on a farm, driving animals, digging, etc., building fences.
Picking grapes, yes. Yeah. Okay, and the other one, hard manual labour, is mining.
That is the worst job, I think, I know we've got ancient evidence telling us that it was basically a death sentence being sent to the mines.
Mm.
And if you know your
Spartacus.
Classic epic movies, yeah, that's where Spartacus starts out.
Yeah.
And really, it's only by being picked off by Peter Ustinov to go and train to be a gladiator that he gets out of that, because he's already a rebellious soul and he would have just been worked to death or whipped to death. And that's the kind of circumstances that people had in the mines. You might threaten your household slave with. You might say, if you don't behave, I'll send you to the mines.
Oh, my parents used to say that to me as well.
So the Greek historian Diodorus Siculus tells us in Book 5 that the slaves engaged in the operation of the mines secure for their masters profits in amounts which are almost beyond belief. They themselves, however, are physically destroyed, their bodies worn down from working in the mine shafts both day and night. Many die because of the excessive maltreatment they suffer. They're given no rest or break from their toil, but are forced by the whiplashes of their overseers to endure the most dreadful of hardships. Thus do they wear out their lives in misery, although they often pray more for death than for life because of the magnitude of their suffering.
Mm.
It's very easy to see there somebody who seems to express empathy for these slaves. This is the worst kind of treatment. But Diodorus Siculus is not saying slavery is a bad thing or even slaves shouldn't be working in the mines. He's just saying this is a circumstance in which people are treated cruelly in the mines. And presumably, people who own the mines don't care. So there are Romans who don't care about this treatment, and there are Romans who think that the harsher end of what slaves have to endure is too much.
Yeah.
We never hear a Roman say the institution of slavery is wrong.
Yeah,
it's
that's
just
quite amazing.
Wrong.
Yeah. The other kind of menial tasks, I suppose, they could be employed in is, well, construction. Somebody had to build Rome into a city of gold.
When I talk to my students and, you know, you show them a photograph of the Colosseum, it's an amazing monument. But there are two things to remember about it. It was a monument built for people to kill animals and other people in. And it was built by slave labor, like all of the amazing monuments we have from ancient Rome. So we might think it looks beautiful and impressive and, you know, the engineering involved is just astounding and, you know, they didn't have nearly the tools we have. But that means that the labor involved in actually doing the building was so much tougher than it would be now. And it could only happen because Rome was a slave society.
So built by slaves for slaves to die in.
Yeah, because of course, one of the other jobs that's primarily done by slaves is that of gladiator, entertainer.
Yes.
And other forms of entertainment too, like being an actor, because all of those entertainment grades are very low level. So it'll mostly be slaves, freedmen, and very low status Romans in general.
So with such a harsh life that slaves can have, there are instances, as you would expect, of slaves revolting.
Yes.
But not as many as you would think.
No, it's much more at an individual level. Mm. I mean, we have famous occasions when they band together and revolt. And of course, the most famous one is the war that Spartacus begins in the 70s BCE. That's kind of the last big slave revolt.
Mm.
Previously, in the 2nd century BCE, in around the 130s, there had been slave revolts, as the Romans would have called them, which had happened in Sicily. And this is coming out of those big farms
where
slaves would have been worked very harshly. The Romans were slightly worried, but not too worried about the servile wars, the slave revolts in Sicily. But it's containable because it's an island.
Mm.
Spartacus in the 70s, far more worrying to them because Rome itself could be in danger. And it's probably one of the reasons, although I'm sure the fear was already there, why they always fear slaves. because this has happened, because Spartacus managed to get an army together that has defeated Roman armies. And that's a terrifying thought to free Romans.
But they came down really hard on Spartacus and his army, and maybe as a result they scared the thoughts of rebellion out of any other slaves for many years to come.
Yeah, well, there don't seem to be any large-scale revolts after this. I mean, it's the reason why Crassus has the 6,000 of Spartacus's army crucified along the Appian Way. It's a public place. You walk along there and you see what happens if you are a slave who rebels against the masters. But that doesn't end individual slaves running away. That happened all the time. Why wouldn't you if your master treated you harshly?
So how did Romans deal with that? Because that's a valuable loss of property, I suppose.
There are two main ways you could employ a slave catcher.
Like a bounty hunter.
Yeah. The fact that you could have this job, that you could be a slave catcher, means that it happened all the time if you could earn a living out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
The other way of sort of preventative was if you felt a slave was somebody who might run away, then something really nasty, but apparently not that uncommon, you could do is put a slave collar around their neck. And we're not talking the kind of collar that you put on your dog, which you can take off at a moment's notice. This is a piece of metal, which is then welded and is sealed at the back. And it's got either writing inscribed around it, this piece of metal, or a sort of pendant hanging off it, which might say something like, here's an example from the collection of Roman inscriptions. It's like the slaves talking, even though this is obviously involuntary that they have this collar on.
Yeah.
I am Asilus, slave of Priectus, who is an administrative officer in the Department of the Grain Supply. I have escaped from my post. Capture me, for I have run away. Return me to the barber's shop near the Temple of Flora.
So that is essentially, if found, please return.
Yeah. My dog has on her collar, which is not made of metal and uncomfortable, her name and my phone number. This is nasty. I think it's particularly emotional to read because of that use of the first person. I am Asilus. It's like Asilus wants this to happen. But Asilus has had this forced upon him. And it's also very mundane, isn't it? I'm owned by someone who's in the Department of the Grain Supply. It's all very bureaucratic and formal. And then saying, this is where you can take me back to and I'll be taken back and probably whipped.
Capture me. Yeah.
When I show students, and we have, you know, this inscription comes from a slave collar that we have. You can go to museums and see them, along with manacles as well. I mean, they had the equivalent of chain gangs. When you show this to students, it really brings them up short. Because while we can think about the institution of slavery and think about it being bad and hear about maltreatment, actually seeing a huge piece of metal that sat around somebody's neck is a whole different thing.
Yeah. So we do hear instances of slaves being freed, although I take it a lot of them died before they even got to consider being freed. So how many slaves were freed? Do we know if it's a large percentage?
We don't know exact percentages. I don't want to sound like I'm mitigating this whole system, but in Roman society, freedom, manumission, setting slaves free was not uncommon.
Okay.
And it might be done because a master wanted to reward a slave for long service. It might be done when the master or mistress dies. There might be manumission in their will. This is not as selfless as it sounds, because if the slaves are set free, if they're now freed people, they can march in the funeral procession, which will give that master status, having a large number of people or a larger number of people in their funeral procession. And of course, they don't really need them anymore. And it might be that they want to give them over to the next generation, but if they don't want to do that, then they can set them free at that point. Also, slaves could save up, because even though slaves are property, and you might think by implication they can't have any property, they could have a small amount of money which was sort of theirs to take care of. And again, it's a grey area. Technically, it belongs to their master. But they could make use of this and they could, say, invest it maybe and make money out of it and save up to buy their freedom if the master's willing.
Or freedom of another slave.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody else who's been set free, who is now able to work and sell their labour, might save up. Because we do know that slave relationships occurred. We know that slaves became fond of each other, or free people became fond of them. So there might be someone else with a vested interest in setting this person free or buying their freedom. And for slaves who'd been set free, Their circumstances change a great deal more than you'd think they might, because when they're set free, they become Roman citizens. I think that's quite extreme and impressive. At the same time as they never really have the status of someone who was born free, they get to have, if they're men, three names now, which is a marker of a Roman citizen. And they have most of the rights of Roman citizens. Some of them they do not. Like they can't marry a senator, that kind of thing. They have to wait three generations down the line before their offspring are allowed to marry those of senatorial rank. So there are still limitations put on them, magistracies, they could hold whatever it is. But, you know, that did not happen in all societies, even where there was manumission, that citizenship is granted to those who've been set free. So this gives us the potential for slaves to rise through Roman society.
Which we do see happening.
We do, and we see a lot of this happening through slaves going into business and making a lot of money. Now, this is a problem for free-born elite Romans. They don't really like to see this. A lot of the texts we have kind of complain about this. Somebody like Tacitus not impressed with freedmen becoming powerful in the imperial household.
Yes.
Or gathering a huge amount of money and then becoming powerful because of that. So it does lead to, especially in the early imperial period, it leads to this tension that's definitely there between rich ex-slaves and those who've traditionally held power who might not even be that wealthy anymore. But there is that potential for social mobility. Now, it's only potential, and as you say, there are a lot of slaves who die in slavery.
Yes, yeah. So for a slave who is given their freedom, they generally always take on the name of their master as one of their own names?
That's the tradition of two of them, actually.
Yes.
For a male slave or ex-slave, they'll keep their own name, which might have been given them to by their master. And they might give them names like Felix, which means happy.
Happy, yeah.
The kind of ironic thing that you might do to a slave.
This sounds like a dog name.
I guess so.
I'm going to have to draw that comparison, sorry. I'm calling a dog Lucky, Felix.
Also, they might just, if they're Greeks, just have a Greek name.
Yeah.
And that's often how you can tell that somebody is an ex-slave, because even though they have the three names of a male Roman citizen, the first two are definitely Roman names, like Gaius Julius.
Yeah.
But the last name is something like Felix or Demetrius.
Or Eurysikes.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, the one you love best, the baker.
It's the one baker that I remember.
With the tomb. Yeah, you see, he's exactly the kind of cashed up freedman that elite Romans would have thought was a bit nouveau and looked down on.
Yeah.
You can imagine also that it's a status marker that your name is on so many
people
of these newly freed people. So there is a kind of beneficence, I suppose, potentially in setting slaves free. And it's also a status marker, if you like. I'm so rich that I don't need to keep these people as slaves.
So even though it wasn't legal for them to have any rights to relationships in their own households, what sort of relationships were slaves having with each other, with their masters?
They were having exactly the same kinds of relationships that people had who were free-born.
Yeah.
All right. So they were forming what they might think of as marriages, or they were having affairs between masters and slaves, very, very common. They had friendships, very close friendships. Sometimes when they were set free, they'd go into business with a fellow ex-slave. And they had friendships that were bonds of affection. A common one that we have some little bit of evidence for is between a slave nurse and the child that she has nursed. So she's a kind of surrogate mother. She's exactly a surrogate mother. And that bond might continue. We have very little evidence that comes directly from slaves. But we do have some in epitaphs. They might be quite short, but they might describe relationships between slaves that wouldn't have been acknowledged by the Roman state. For example, we have inscriptions that talk about contubernium. So not connubium, which is marriage, but contubernium, which means tent sharing, and is a term that comes from the army. So if you're in the army, you might have a tent sharer. And it's a kind of stand-in for marriage, which they can't necessarily claim as slaves.
Could be what happens in the army stays in the army. But anyway, read out your epitaph.
There could be that too, but I wasn't going to go that way. But here's an example of an inscription, which I particularly like because it involves two women. What was going on there? Starts off exactly like all Roman epitaphs, to the spirits of the dead. Panope the hairdresser, slave of Quintus Volusus, lived 22 years. And Phoebe, her assistant, lived 37 years. Spendo, He's only got one name, so he's another slave, made this tomb for himself and his contubernales, his tent sharers, who well deserve it. So what he's saying there is, I regarded these women as my spouse.
Yeah.
Whether they were at the same time or separately, we can only speculate. But that's not uncommon, and it's not always two women, to find these inscriptions that talk about contubernales, that talk about, we had this close, affectionate sexual relationship. It's the same as having a wife as far as we're concerned.
Yeah.
It's just we're not allowed to use that word.
And between the master and the slave, you also get evidence of those sort of relationships?
Yes. There are inscriptions that come from the master's point of view that often celebrate slaves or ex-slaves.
Mm.
And as I was saying, the nursing of children might form that bond. So here's an example, to the spirits of the dead, again.
Yes.
To Servia Cornelia Sabina. Now, she's got three names. That means she's an ex-slave. And indeed, the next phrase says, freedwoman of Servius. Servius Cornelius Dolabella Metilianus. I have to say most of the inscription is his name, the master's name. Servius made this tomb for his nurse and mummy, who well deserved it. He calls her his mummy. She's not his mummy. She's his stand-in mummy because she was a slave. And he has this fabulous four names. He's a very upper-class Roman. Whether she felt the same, we don't know. But he felt this bond of affection for the woman who had nursed him as a baby.
And she's got two of her names from his.
Exactly, yes.
Servia Cornelia.
Yeah, what usually happened with women is they took one name from the ex-master, but she's got two of them. So, you know, you can play around with that a little bit. We also get evidence of ex-slaves or maybe slaves having bonds of affection that aren't necessarily to do with sexual relationships. So here's an example. Clearly two ex-slaves. We can tell by their names. To Aulus Memmius Clarus, Aulus Memmius Urbanus. You see, they've got the same two names at the beginning.
So they're both slaves together.
The same master.
Freed by the same guy.
To his fellow freedman and his dearest companion. I do not remember, my most virtuous fellow freedman, that there was ever any quarrel between you and me. By this epitaph, I call on the gods above and the gods below as witnesses that I met you in the slave market and we were made free men together in the same household and that nothing ever separated us except the day of your death.
Ah.
Oh, isn't that lovely?
That's really nice.
Yeah. That's evidence of these kind of lifelong bonds being made, as he literally says there, in the slave market.
Yes. But
they've been together since then, and they were just lucky enough to be employed in the same, or made slaves in the same household from which they were subsequently set free. I took that directly out of Sandra Joshal's book, Slavery in the Roman World, which I highly recommend.
So you've got slavery in different periods of Rome. You've got it going back into the Republic days. You've got it going way into the Imperial days. How did it change in that time broadly?
Very early on, it seems to have been possible for Romans to go voluntarily into slavery in order to pay off a debt. So it's what we call debt slavery.
Okay.
But that was abolished very early on. And I'm talking early Republic, not even mid-Republic, really. The Romans didn't like that. They didn't like that idea. It blurred the boundaries. If you're free, you're meant to stay free. Mm. You don't voluntarily become a slave. That's wrong. Various laws were passed at various times to kind of restrict the category of slave and to prevent relationships between the free and slaves. We've talked before about the Romans being anxious about morality, and one of the ways they sometimes dealt with this, as the Emperor Claudius did, is to bring in laws about cohabitation between a free person and a slave. And it's particularly directed at women. Free women shouldn't cohabit with a slave. That would reduce them to the status of slave, which, of course, as I've already mentioned, is the worst thing for a Roman.
Yes.
It's what they perceive as social death. There are variations to this, when you can or when you couldn't do it, but generally he doesn't want this to be something that's happening.
Okay, so you get tinkering throughout the years about what it means to be a slave or how you can treat slaves and what the extent of it is. But as you said earlier, it is always an accepted part of the Roman Empire. It has never been challenged. So how did slavery end then?
It seems to have become economically unviable in the later Roman Empire, which, of course, is a period I'm not an expert on.
Disclaimer. Now,
some people sort of see it as coinciding with the rise of Christianity, but this is, in a way, a coincidence. Even though Christianity seems to deal with and appeal to those who are marginalized in society, we can tell from certainly those who have to deal with both Christian dogma, kind of involved in the forming of Christian dogma at St. Paul, and Rome, because St. Paul was a Roman citizen, Paul's answer is not the abolition of slavery. Mm. All might be the same before Christ, but that's when we die. So there's a good example of this in one of Paul's letters where he has come across a runaway slave. And what he does is sends that slave back with a letter asking the master to be merciful. He doesn't help him to escape.
Mm.
You know, it takes a long time. Christianity is around for a long time and Christians do have slaves. But it's true that Christianity did appeal to slaves and women because it kind of gave you this idea of an afterlife where you wouldn't suffer the same kinds of restrictions as you do in life, I suppose. But it's not true to say in a very simplistic way that Christianity led to the abolition of slavery.
Okay. So now that we've talked about slavery and all that it involves, what are some famous slaves that we know of? And I'm also taking Spartacus off the table because he's a separate number of podcasts altogether.
Okay.
Product placement.
I suppose he is, yes. I suppose he is the most famous slave of all.
But who is there besides Spartacus?
Well, there is Antonia Caenis, an ex-slave and was Vespasian's mistress for a long time.
Mm.
So the Emperor Vespasian's mistress. She was a former slave of Antonia, the mother of Claudius. From all that we have, it seems that Vespasian held her in very high esteem. She was much more than a fling to him. I mean, it was very long-standing, and he pretty much regarded her as his wife, even though she couldn't legitimately hold that position.
Okay, yeah.
It's possible. Some people think that the Republican playwright Terence was a slave. His full name was Publius Terentius Afer, and the Afer at the end means African. And we have a biography, but it's kind of a late biography. We don't know how reliable it is, that says that he was brought to Rome by a Roman senator, Terentius Lucanus. He wrote a lot of comedies around the family, an amazing poet. And in fact, it kind of enhanced his career that he was connected to this famous Roman or this well-heeled Roman potentially. So he may have been an ex-slave. One of the other famous ones is, and especially I think through some recent novels, is Cicero's former slave, Marcus Tullius Tiro, takes Cicero's first two names.
Yeah.
And he is sort of his administrator and secretary and published his works after Cicero's death. So heavily involved in Cicero's literary legacy and clearly held in high esteem by Cicero, who often refers to him in his letters. And Pertinax, who was briefly emperor after the emperor Commodus.
For a whole 3 months.
Second century, not very long standing, it's true.
Yeah.
Who was not a slave, but he was the son of a freedman, Helvius Successus.
It kind of shows you how far a slave can go, I suppose, if they're in the right household.
By that period, yes. Yeah. And this is a whole other issue. Maybe we need a podcast on freedmen.
Mm.
That freedmen can get very close to power, much closer to power than ordinary Romans, ordinary freeborn Romans. So in a way, there is the potential for a small minority of ex-slaves to have more power than a lot of apparently powerful Romans.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Reviews, as always, are appreciated. We love to hear from the audience. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I am at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we look at the life of Rome's most famous slave. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.